New Horizons is sponsored in part by the Idaho Humanities Council, deepening understanding of human experience by connecting people with ideas.
Today on New Horizons, Curtis Bonk, Indiana University professor and author of The World is Open, How Web Technology is Revolutionizing Education.
There are 10 trends I map out. If any one of those trends had happened, it would be a huge change. But the fact is, 10 things have happened simultaneously and converged. And that has offered new opportunities for learning, not only at the higher ed level, but K-12 and corporate training and government settings and all over. One thing this free content does is it dips the toes of people in the water and gets them to rethink about their educational opportunities. But there still is some hesitancy, reluctance on the part of people who haven't been exposed.
I'm Bob Kustra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. We live in a world of wikis and blogs, Skype and Second Life, podcasting and posting. The last decade of online technological advancements has irreversibly entwined our virtual lives with our real ones, and nowhere are the impacts deeper or the future more promising than in education. Today's guest, Curtis Bonk, explores this important issue in his book, The World is Open, How Web Technology is Revolutionizing Education. Dr. Bonk is an award-winning professor at Indiana University with expertise in educational psychology and instructional systems technology. He has been investigating innovations in education since the early 1990s, but it wasn't until 2007 that he started writing a book that has been called an inspiring story for the 21st century and a riveting guide to the future of learning. The World is Open moves from Plato's Academy in the 4th century B.C. to the eyeball-to-eyeball classroom of the 20th century, demonstrating the alarming lack of change in the time between and the opportunity for innovation that the Internet revolution brings. Dr. Bonk takes stock of the growing treasury of free educational resources online and offers a roadmap for schools, governments, and corporations to take advantage and support the success and intellectual might of all citizens. Dr. Bonk joins us today by phone from his home in Bloomington, Indiana. Curtis Bonk, welcome to New Horizons.
Hey, Bob. It's great to be here.
Well, I understand that this book that you've written really has some of its existence due to the fact that you read another book in 2005 called The World is Flat, a book we all know about, Thomas Friedman's book, and that got you to thinking about how that might apply to education.
You know, I not only read his book, I listened to it in my car, and then I got the little 2-ounce playaway device and listened to it again while I was jogging. So, you know, there are many ways to learn from any kind of materials today, and that one in particular. You can watch a video of him with Charlie Rose interviewing Friedman. And as I was reading, watching, listening to his ideas, I got invited to give a keynote out in Vancouver for the eLearn conference. And I said, well, what can I do? How about I try and take some of his ideas and extend them into education? Because I saw the first third of the World is Flat book really being about education. And I said, you know, there are similar trends. And many of the things he discusses, wikis and podcasting and Google, have definite applicability to education. And education underlies this flatter world. So I started exploring it. And the first time I spoke on it, the title was called Oops, I Didn't Mean to Share That. And it was a little pun on a couple open source projects, which were translating MIT contents, free contents and courses to Chinese, free to the world, by my good friend Lucifer Chu, now who's translated Lord of the Rings to Chinese and made $1 million and took half the money to translate free contents from MIT. So the long and the short of it is I gave a little talk at a conference, and lo and behold, Lucifer flew in from Taiwan to be on stage with me to talk about the open source software world, what it means to people in China. And Microsoft people were there, and they said, how would you like to come to Microsoft next week and talk to our execs about the free and open source software world? And at that point, I came home and told my son, he said, Dad, you need to write a book. This is, if Microsoft's interested in the free and open source software world, well. And so to come back to the little interesting phenomenon, this week, Thomas Friedman's on my campus to speak about his new book. So I'm going to maybe get a chance to meet him later on this week.
Well, now, when you titled your book, The World is Open, help those who might not be as tech savvy as you are understand exactly what you're getting at.
you know, what I'm trying to point out is that, you know, in the past, when, you know, when I was a board accountant, that was my previous life as an accountant or CPA, sitting in Milwaukee and Cube Farms, I knew I wanted to get additional education. And the only way I could really, while working full-time, was taking courses at night, courses through the television, courses via correspondence. And I did. And I was able to get into an educational psychology program at Madison through that. But now, 25 years later, the opportunities to learn non-traditionally have exploded and have opened up so that people can be learning through online courses, or courses that combine face-to-face and online in what's called a blended format, through podcasts, and you listen in your, on your iPod, and then take some tests and activities via the Internet. There are a number of ways that we can learn today, and the point, I guess, is that if any one trend had happened, mobile learning, virtual learning, or online learning, e-books, there are 10 trends I map out, and e-books is the first one, and then e-learning is the second one, and the 10 trends end up spelling the acronym We All Learn. If any one of those trends had happened, it would be a revolution. It would be a huge change, but the fact is 10 things have happened simultaneously and converged, and that has offered new opportunities for learning not only at the higher ed level, but K-12 and corporate training and government settings and all over. So we can now learn from our cars, from our mobile devices, from our laptops, notebooks, you name it.
You say that Plato was, in effect, the first distance educator. How so?
Well, you know, the books at that time, books were in their early form. And so people didn't necessarily have to be at his, you know, orations. They could take his books and travel with them and read them and discuss them. And so, in effect, the geography became extended. We didn't have to be an academos to learn directly from him. You know, Socrates said this is going to warp the mind, in effect. We'll lose our memory skills. And we now hear the same kinds of contentions about Google and Wikipedia and other technologies, so calculators, 20, 30 years ago, right?
That's right.
Yeah, each new technology comes to the stage, and we hear the rebuttal pro and con about how it's going to change things and drastically reduce, you know, the article is Google Making Us Stupid became popular last year, right?
What about eyeball-to-eyeball learning? Help us understand how we have to move beyond it.
Well, you know, the best book someone can buy for a dollar on Amazon used is a book by a guy at Wisconsin, a professor who taught the first distance learning course back in the 1950s. And he actually helped create the Open U in the UK. His name is Charles Wiedemeyer. And he actually didn't get in my book as much as I had hoped. I'll make a little side point. I had to cut about half of the stuff out, and so I'm trying to create a free book. And so there's a website that has a lot of free stuff if people want to take a look at worldisopen.com. And just cut out the, just worldisopen.com. And I'm hoping to put a free book up, which will end with information on Charles Wiedemeyer. Now, Wiedemeyer talks about eyeball-to-eyeball learning, ear-pan-to-ear-pan learning, in that what was happening in the 50s and 60s and 70s is that people were exploring television and satellite radio as alternatives to the traditional classroom setting where it's just eyeball-to-eyeball and ear-pan-to-ear-pan. You hear from a lecturer who goes up and pontificates, and then you take tasks on that. And his book, Learning at the Back Door, he's got more, I think, insight about adult learners in that book from 1981 than maybe any book written since then. All that he talks about, and he has pictures of a young Russian kid who looks into a school. He's peering in, but not allowed in because it's an elitist school. And he has another picture of a kid with all sorts of resources at home and able to learn from any of them. But today, we don't have to peer in through the back door. You can learn from Stanford professors through iTunes. You can learn from Berkeley professors through YouTube or Cornell or Yale or Harvard or MIT. In effect, anyone can now learn anything from anyone else at any time. And that's a bold claim, but the point is we're moving away from eyeball-to-eyeball learning to a more variety or more assortment of learning opportunities that never existed before, and what I'm trying to do is to help some people frame it in one way to try and make sense of it. This is one slice of my We All Learn model, my 10 trends. There are probably many other ways to slice up the pie.
Let's focus for a minute on your comment about the fact that you can go onto iTunes today and you can go onto the Stanford podcast and take down some lectures and learn in that fashion. However, so many people who are interested in learning are doing so because they want that learning to be certified, to be validated, to be recognized officially in the form of some kind of a degree which passes muster on a resume for a job. And it's there that some of this seems to break down for me. Of course, there's all kinds of information out there in cyberspace, but it's a matter of how we convert it to the uses consumers must need it for. You have, and I know that in your book you discuss this, that there are some developments underway that perhaps will help consumers or those offering the courses certify their work.
This is historically a new movement, and we're about 10 years in since Charles Vest at MIT made his grand announcement that all MIT courses will be put up within a decade, and they are. Oh, 1,900 courses, and I don't normally apply for jobs, but I threw my resume in right away. They never called, but to be a director of that program. I thought it was exciting back in 2001 when I heard it. And so we're at the point now, a decade later, where it's not just MIT, but many community colleges, I mean, Foothills Community College in San Francisco, and many K-12 schools, for that matter, are putting up contents on the web, and there are portals being developed that are indexing or helping us categorize all that content. That's a first step. They can go to Merlot.org and find 22,000 free contents from anthropology to zoology with peer review. They can go to Connections out of Rice University, C-O-N-N-E-X-I-O-N-S, with it's a repository of free ebooks and simulations and animations. There are many of these portals springing up. The next phase, what we see happening, is some kind of certification. Even MIT is making rumbles about some kind of certification or course credentialing around the contents. There's already a university that sprung up called the University of the People by a guy who had been the former chairman of Cramster. His name is Shai Reshef. I allude to him briefly in the book. He had 180 students the first semester and 800 instructors, 5 instructors for every student. Now, it's not a branded university, and he still doesn't have accreditation yet, but this is the first wave of what we're seeing happening. Peer-to-peer university, P2PU, is offering tutors and guides through the content. What I think is going to happen, and I've written on this, I've written up 10 ways why instructors would do this in a college setting, 10 reasons why universities would take a stab at this, and 10 reasons why a learner would get involved in this open access. One of the things learners can do, I've read about stories of people being in hospitals who take courses on English from Yale and get excited about going back to college after being laid up in a hospital or being stuck at home ill. So one thing this free content does is it dips the toes of people in the water and gets them to rethink about their educational opportunities. So that's one thing. The second thing is it helps market MIT and others. It's a branded identity of having your contents freely available to kids in Iraq or Afghanistan to learn engineering content who never would have had access to it previously. And for instructors to market their ideas and to get feedback on maybe where they're incorrect. I mean, MIT professors are taking suggestions on some of the content that they've put on the web that maybe has changed. So it's not just about credentialing, although that's the next phase I think we're going to enter into. I think what's going to happen, Bob, is that most universities are going to offer certificates, maybe a course or two on the web for free, as a way to get people into a certificate program or a master's program or a degree completion program. There'll be this one or two off courses that will be free that will get people's interest, and people will see maybe interdisciplinary kinds of opportunities across the free contents that no one had recognized previously. So I think that's the next phase and where we're headed, but we're only a decade in, and so there's a lot of new thought and new thinking that needs to be done here.
And I do understand that you are a pioneer in this area, you and your colleagues, and your book does a great job of pointing out some of the pioneering efforts. But I must say, as a university president, when I survey what we are doing across universities and colleges in America, most of our students still show up for eyeball-to-eyeball education. And I guess I'm curious as to your take on why it is so difficult to get faculty. And maybe it's not just a faculty issue, but why is it so difficult to move people in the academy when it comes to adapting to the kinds of technologies you're talking about?
Well, the resistance movement has started to come down during the past couple of years, to be honest, as I travel around the world. But there still is some hesitancy, reluctance on the part of people who haven't been exposed. So familiarity on the part of instructors, and some universities require instructors to take an online class before they'll let them teach one, and that's a way to get exposure. But I think it's partly familiarity. It's partly the support structures in place, of course, the expectations for tenure, and it's partly the newness of the technology and how quickly it's changing. When you have systemic events like that that are both challenges, barriers, as well as opportunities, you'll have some people looking at the opportunities, some people looking at the challenges. I think we've been at this since 1996, 97, when really people started jumping into the web. And now we're 12, 13, 14 years later, we're at this point in time where people can no longer say, I can wait it out. And so I see the same people who were throwing tomatoes at me 10 years ago, not exactly tomatoes, but waiting for me to leave their campus. And, you know, I'd come in and do a little, you know, workshop or whatever. Now they're coming in droves, and they're starting to say, you know, this is something important to our students. And then you have administrators who see that the new enrollments are coming from online instruction, not from the face-to-face classes. And you have 25% of students, at least, who have had at least one online class in their college careers. And you have high school students, over a million middle and high school students who have online experience, who are going to be coming into campus settings expecting similar. You have a snowballing effect happening now. And I think this resistance movement is now turning into a training movement, a support movement. We're moving into the next phase here as well. Although there, of course, are people who are a little bit resistant, and what I do for them is I point out the movie What About Bob, where Bill Murray takes baby steps out there, and I give people some low-risk, low-cost, low-time activities, and there are many of them that they can do, and they start putting them in their classes and trying them out.
At a time when public universities and colleges are really struggling with resources, state appropriations are being cut back dramatically, to some, I suppose, online learning may look like a great cost savings because you're taking people out of the classroom and you're throwing them online and, oh, it's going to be so efficient. My pedestrian way of looking at it, and I don't by any means seem to be an expert on this, it seems to me that it's a significant upfront investment. I don't know, maybe down the road there's going to be some cost savings, but when it comes to the man hours required to prepare online courses and teach them, I guess I ask you, are we really talking about any savings here, or is this just another medium with no significant difference in cost at the end of the day?
Should I put my CPA, old CPA, corporate controller?
Absolutely, that's the best.
My university one. Let me just point out that there's front ends, of course, as you're mentioning here. There's front ends not only in terms of the university or college or department, but front end in terms of both the students and the instructors. I mean, the hardest part of an online class for a student is the first week. The hardest part of a face-to-face class for a student is the last week. You know, think about that. And the same goes definitely for the instructor. The hardest part of an online class for the instructor is the 2 months before the class starts, because you're setting all this up. You're setting the wheel in motion. But once you've taught a class the first time, and my department chair who hired me 20-some years ago or 18 years ago had come to Indiana, he taught a class with 7 students online and almost died and in educational psychology, and he became our associate dean. And he said, Kurt, you can teach it now. And I said, well, it's got 20, Jack, and you almost died last semester with 7. And I almost died with 20. And then the next time I taught it with 25, and it was easy. And the next time with 30, even easier. The point is you could have one person online the first semester or even in a face-to-face class, one person, and it's hard. Now, to go into the cost issue, and for the students the first time around, it's difficult because you're making sense of a new spectrum of learning, all the opportunities. I mean, I've got a class right now on the Web 2.0 with a 43-page syllabus, and everything's a hot link. You know, the 43 pages is a little daunting for students and the instructor, but believe me, it's exciting, too. In terms of cost, I think Central Florida University, University of Central Florida, is probably the place to look. It's the place to benchmark. They can't grow through state appropriation monies. The state of Florida has no money for it, and I understand the state of Ohio is in, or Idaho is in similar, but not as bad as Florida right now, or California. But, well, actually, I've heard there's new monies in Idaho, isn't there?
I haven't found them yet, but I'll keep looking.
Florida is growing. Central Florida is now the biggest campus in all of Florida. It's bigger than Florida State, and it's bigger than the University of Florida. And what they're doing is blended learning, where they might alternate face-to-face and online engineering classes. They might have 1,000 students in a face-to-face lecture hall with another 500 to 1,000 students at remote sites watching through streaming lectures. They figured out ways to blend so that each time I'm showing up at Central Florida and taking a look, there's a new building and parking structure, but they're telling me there's twice as many online ones that I don't even see. So they've created kind of a return on investment calculations for, you know, looking at space savings and, you know, cost savings because of not having as many classroom buildings, and figuring out the schedules so that they maximize classroom space use when they can. So, yes, there are additional costs involved in creating online classes. There are also some cost decreases in terms of building space and so forth. New models are being created here. And in the end of the day, I think we're going to see cost savings over time because of reuse of content and because of the savings on space. But we're still at the early stages.
You're listening to Curtis Bonk. He is an Indiana University professor and author of The World is Open, How Web Technology is Revolutionizing Education. Back in the dark ages, Kurt, before we really got into technology and learning, I remember we used to joke about the fact that if you were going off to teach in high school, you would have to go through some courses that taught you how to teach. But if you were going on to graduate school to get your doctorate, you could more than likely walk into your very first class as a new PhD without one course teaching you how to teach. Now, some of that's changed along the way. And of course, graduate students do get experience in the classroom when they're serving as teaching assistants and things like that. I guess I have to ask the same thing about how this applies to this idea of learning technologies. What is the experience in the graduate school of today? Has graduate school education changed any? With the understanding, of course, that what you're trying to do here is prepare a new generation of teachers who are going to be more comfortable using this technology, as opposed to gray hairs like myself, who may be a little bit more resistant because they've always done it the other way.
You do see this change happening as well. Here at Indiana, our dean has decided on a laptop program where if you get 16 hours of training to use a laptop in your classes or to use technology in your classes, you get a laptop. If you give 8 hours of training, you get a laptop. So that's one approach that can, in effect, create a different cultural atmosphere. I mean, we celebrate technology integration on this campus with summer poster sessions among faculty. We have a couple technology days. We have brown bag lunches where faculty share what they've learned, share how they're teaching with technology, and you get a free lunch. I mean, it's not just a one-off solution. It's a systemic thing. It's a combination of online help and support and exam best practices combined with laptop programs or iPads or whatever it is. There are different kinds of systemic initiatives I've seen across college campuses.
I want to mention for our listeners especially who might be interested in investigating the possibilities for online education, you mentioned in your book the Online Education Database. Could you explain for them just how you could access that and what it's going to show you?
Yeah, you can have all sorts of online education databases that are available for for different concepts and books and ideas. For instance, my R2-D2 book, all 100 activities are available in a database where people can look for low-risk, low-cost, low-time activities, and boom, you've got one that comes up that you might be able to use. There are databases for open access to contents. As I mentioned, Merlot and Connections earlier, there's something called the National Repository of Online Courses, and there's something called the OER Commons, or Open Education Resources Commons, which if you just type in Google OER Commons or National Repository of Online Courses, NROC, you can get hundreds and hundreds of classes that are freely available from nutrition, public health, accounting, sociology. So these portals of content, I think, are the first way in which we're making sense of the content. I think there's going to be another wave that will be more intelligent filtering through that content, if you will. But that's where we're at today. So Merlot, Connections, OER, and NROC are kind of four places. And I've just recently created a kind of a portal of all these free video sites off of my homepage. If people go to my homepage or go to TrainingShare, I have a website, trainingshare.com, with all that. So my point is that books and portals of content, number one and number five of my 10 trends, in effect, are easy for people to digest because in a face-to-face classroom, we have books and we have lectures. So while I thought those two would be least important, they're the way in which we're starting, and we'll move into the other eight trends, I think, after ebooks and after portals. Does that make sense?
It does, but give us your homepage again so we'll have a chance to hook up.
Yeah, well, if you go to trainingshare.com, that would get you into my homepage. Well, it has a link to my homepage. It has a link to all the resources for the book. And the book itself, worldisopen.com, has a prequel, a postscript, all the references, all the web links, a lot of free stuff, in effect, all the 27 videos I mentioned. So if you can just go to worldisopen.com, and I hope to have a free book up someday soon that people can have. But, you know, it's a... Gosh, there's so much going on. It's hard to keep up on all this, even for me.
One final question, and we are running out of time here, but I just have to get this in. I'm fascinated by one of those 10 technology trains called Second Life, what you refer to as alternative reality learning. To help people better understand how that would be put to use in education, I wonder if you could just comment on it and maybe even direct us to a website. I may be wrong about this, but I thought I read in your book that George Mason University has a Center for History and the New Media, and there's something called ECHO that's a part of that that may be about applying history to Second Life. Am I correct in what I remember for your reading?
Yeah, George Mason does, and the University of Virginia, along with UCLA, have a website, Rome Reborn 1.0, where you can experience Senate halls and you know, the Colosseum and so forth. But to use Second Life, there's actually a website that people might take a look at. It's called, just type in educational uses of Second Life, and you'll get a whole compendium
Perfect.
Of different ways in which Second Life is being used to do teacher training for technologies, the question you just raised, or to do paramedic or medical training at UT Austin, I think, has dozens of islands for their medical training in Second Life. So it runs the gamut from many professional schools teaching medical, you know, law, business, but also in the social science area as well, in psychology and history and economics and so forth.
Great. Well, Kurt, we've run out of time. As I was telling you before the show, our faculty and staff have assembled in the form of a committee to investigate here at Boise State how we can apply technology to teaching and learning here on campus. Of course, we're already doing it, but I'm talking about getting in with both feet. Your book, in the meantime, is The World is Open, How Web Technology is Revolutionizing Education. Thank you very much, Kurt. It's really nice having you on the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Curtis Bonk, author of The World is Open, How Web Technology is Revolutionizing Education. Next week, Greg Easterbrook, author of Sonic Boom, Globalization at Mach Speed. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Aaron Ryan. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.